Okay, so we're picking up now with that big lie I told you about earlier, that second narrative emble, the death of his grandmother. And here's why I say it's a lie. Well, before I tell you how it's a lie, let me show you how he sets it up, right? It's glorious writing. It's really well done. And just as he talks about with the slave songs and how they'll teach you about slavery more than any book on philosophy, he says, "If any one thing in my experience more than another served to deepen my conviction of the infernal character of slavery," and there we are with the infernal term again, bringing us back to Dante's Inferno, "and fill me with the unutterable loathing of slaveholders, it was their base ingratitude to my poor old grandmother. She had served my old master faithfully from youth to old age. She had been the source of all his wealth. She had peopled his plantation with slaves. She had become a great grandmother in his service." And there we see that repetition again, over and over again, that leading phrase that he fills out three different ways. "She had rocked him in infancy, attended him in childhood, and served him through life, and at his death, wiped from his icy brow the cold death sweat and closed his eyes forever." And now instead of three, he goes to four there, right? "She was nevertheless left a slave for life, a slave in the hands of strangers." And basically, she's being left with these strangers who find, as he says, "finding her of little use, her frame already racked with the pains of old age and complete helplessness fast stealing over her once active limbs, they took her to the woods, built her a little hut, put up a little mud chimney, and then made her welcome to the privilege of supporting herself there in perfect loneliness, thus virtually turning her out to die." That idea that this is the privilege of supporting herself is a little bit of irony there, obviously, from him, a little bit of sarcasm there. And then here's the thing that tells you that he's making this up, because he phrases this all in the conditional. "If my poor old grandmother now lives, she lives to suffer in utter loneliness." He begins with if. He doesn't know whether she's alive or dead, but that doesn't matter because what he's going to do next is he puts you, it's called composition of place. He makes you imagine this scene. He puts you there as this vicarious visitor, this voyeur, watching this scene of the grandmother as if you're there at her moment of death. "If my poor old grandmother now lives, she lives to suffer in utter loneliness. She lives to remember and mourn over the loss of children, the loss of grandchildren, and the loss of great-grandchildren." And then he has this little passage here from Whittier, John Greenleaf Whittier, a popular dialect poet at the time. But when he comes back from that little passage from the poem, boy, the tone is completely different, right? And it's direct address. He's telling you, he's giving you this story. It's not him talking to you, it's you seeing the scene. The hearth is desolate. The children, the unconscious children, who once sang and danced in her presence are gone. She gropes her way in the darkness of age for a drink of water. Instead of the voices of children, she hears by day the moans of the dove and by night the screams of the hideous owl. All is gloom. The grave is at the door. And now, when weighed down by the pains and aches of old age, when the head inclines to the feet, when the beginning and ending of human existence meet, and helpless infancy and painful old age combine together at this time, this most needful time, the time for the exercise of that tenderness and affection which children only can exercise toward a declining parent, my poor old grandmother, the devoted mother of 12 children, is left all alone in yonder little hut before a few dim embers. She stands, she sits, she staggers, she falls, she groans, she dies. And there are none of her children or grandchildren present to wipe from her wrinkled brow the cold sweat of death, or to place beneath the sod her fallen remains. Will not a righteous God visit for these things? Oh, that damning last line of the paragraph. Will not a righteous God visit? Will not he wreak his justice for these things? The great injustice, the intolerable inhumanity that's being done here. He wants you to feel this, right? This whole paragraph is about emotionally responding to the death of his grandmother. But he's not even sure that she's dead. I think that's really kind of, it's convincing, it's very romantic, but it is kind of problematic in terms of whether he's telling the truth or not. So in our passage then to the next big narrative emble, the escape, the thing that we expect to be the climax of this piece, we're going to come across the longest paragraph in the text. This long, long story that really is kind of problematic. You know, he's been bashing Christianity. He's been talking about how all these Christian slaveholders use the Bible to justify what they're doing, right? They twist and turn the words of God to create something, to justify it to themselves, right? And he swears it's done out of self-loathing and intolerance. But this really long story about this overseer, Mr. Covey, with whom he gets into a fight, and he runs away, and he's trying to escape. Well, he's not really sure that he's going to want to escape, but he runs upon a freed slave, an older black man named Sandy, right? I tell him that Covey says he's going to get hold of him, and he runs off, right? I started off to Covey's in the morning, right? And there was Covey with his cowskin to give me another whipping. I succeeded to finally get into this cornfield, and I spent, right, I knew I eventually I'd have to come home for something to eat, but I fell in with Sandy Jenkins, the slave with whom I was somewhat acquainted. Sandy had a free wife who lived about 4 miles from Mr. Covey's, and it being Saturday, he was on his way to see her. So he tells Sandy this, and Sandy says, listen, I got the solution for you. Here it is. We're going to go off into the woods. We're going to pick this root, he says, where there was a certain root, which if I would take some of it with me, carrying it always on my right side, would render it impossible for Mr. Covey or any other white man to whip me. He said he had carried it for years, and since he had done so, he had never received a blow and never expected to while he carried it. Well, Douglas at first says, this is ridiculous. This is superstitious, right? But then he says, well, you know, it can't hurt me and it might help me, so I'll try it. And it's this root incident that, remember, Christianity was forced upon these African slaves who were brought over here, you know, believing something totally different. We'll talk about that at the end of the semester when we look at Soyinka's Death and the King's Horseman. We'll talk about one of the big religions there, Yoruba, and the notion of animism, the notion that there are objects of power on this earth that work for people, and religion shows its power if you believe, right? So Douglas says, okay, he's going to do that. He's going to take that. And he thinks, you know, I'll put it on him, right? So he goes back, carries it upon his right-hand side, and he goes Sunday morning, he starts for home, and there's Covey's on his way to meeting, going to church, right? Sunday go to meeting. He spoke to him kindly. Now, that's odd, given what just occurred between them, right? And knew that he wouldn't, Douglas knew that he wouldn't have anything going on for Sunday. But on Monday, as he says, the virtue of the root was fully tested. He's going to rub down the horses to feed and curry them. And here comes Covey entering the stable with a long rope. Covey now seemed to think he had me, but Douglas fights back. I resolved to fight, and suiting my action to the resolution, I seized Covey hard by the throat, and as I did so, I rose. He held on to me, and I to him. My resistance was so entirely unexpected that Covey seemed taken all aback. He trembled like a leaf, and this gave me some assurance. So these guys start fighting. So Covey calls over some other slaves for help. The other slave said, I got nothing to do with this, right? I watched my chance, and I gave him a heavy kick close to the ribs. And I love this. I like to see kind of this fight as this goes on, right? The first guy that comes over is Hughes, and Hughes is gone. And Bill shows up, but Bill wanted to know what he could do. Covey said, take hold of him. And, right, and Bill says, right? His master hired him out to work and not to whip me, right? Says, I got my own problems, right? So I'm not helping you, right? The truth was, as Douglas says, he hadn't whipped me at all. How long does he say they went on for? I think he says they went on for like 2 hours fighting back and forth. Bill wanted to know, right? How long this went on? The truth was, he hadn't whipped me at all. I considered him as getting entirely the worst end of the bargain, for he had drawn no blood from me, but I had from him. The whole 6 months afterwards that I spent with Mr. Covey, he never laid the weight of his finger upon me in anger. He would occasionally say he didn't want to get a hold of me again, you know, kind of as a warning. And Douglas thinks to himself, no, you need not, for you'll come off worse than you did before. This is the kind of, you know, you've seen guys after fights, after barroom brawls or something. You know the standard move, right? Oh, you look bad. Well, you should see the other guy. This is certainly it. And listen, if you've been in a barroom fight, if you've been in any kind of fight for your life like this, you know these things don't last a couple hours. You know these things don't last more than 5 minutes, right? This is exhausting, right? They are really fighting for their lives here, right? So he holds him and they fight. And he, this goes on. He says, this battle, somehow, give it to me. I don't know why he didn't do this. I fought back. I don't know where I found this spirit. The only thing that's different, hey, he's got this root in his pocket. Could it be? Could it be that the root had something to do with this? Well, maybe, right? He said, himself had been repelled by force, the bloody arm of slavery. I felt as I never felt before. It was a glorious resurrection from the tomb of slavery. Well, from a guy who started this text talking about how he's ignorant just like every other slave, wow, now it's this glorious resurrection from the tomb of slavery. Seems to me that, I'm not saying he's got a Jesus complex here, but that's certainly the imagery he's hitting us with. Because what he's going to do next, too, is great, right? Using this Christianity, all the while keeping that root on him, all the while referring back to this animistic religion, the pre-Christian religion, right? He's going to give us the outward appearance of Christianity. In fact, he's going to use that. Because what does he do when he supposedly is teaching Sunday school? Is he telling them Bible stories? Is he talking about Jesus, little Jesus, meek and mild? Think of the Blake poem, The Lamb. Nope. He is essentially arming those slaves with Blake's tiger. He is giving them the pathway that he knows. He's teaching them how to read and write. And so it's the kind of the final example we have of this masking that we talk about there with the root incidents, right? That masking up across the top, the Sunday school where he teaches how to read and write. That's glorious there, right? Meanwhile, all the slave owners think that he's teaching the slaves to be more docile, when in actuality, like follow the drinking gourd, like the supposed ignorance of the slaves, he is teaching them something that these white people will never know. That rolls us right into the escape, which is going to happen in that big chapter as well, right? And just where we'd expect kind of the part of this, the action movie where we should see the biggest part of the explosion, you know, where more people get shot and we use more bullet time, slow-mo or whatever, right? We get a deliberate turn, right? Our third big embo, instead of telling us what happened, instead of giving us the action, instead tells us how Douglas felt about it, how it makes him feel. And he gives us good reasons why he can't tell us the action, right? He tells us, well, you know, I don't want to compromise this route because other people might use it. And certainly the people who helped me, I don't want to send them to jail. Remember, the fugitive slave law is still in effect the first time he writes this, right? He's got literally a bounty on his head and federal law that says that any owner can come and reclaim their property over any state boundary, right? So it isn't until these British abolitionists buy his freedom that he's actually free of that. And that solves one thing, but that doesn't get those other people who helped him off the hook. So he doesn't tell us his story. He doesn't tell us what went on. We get a little bit about it, and then we get lots of excuses, right? We get how he felt and how he feels that he's kind of alone in the North. It's different for slaves in the North, wouldn't it be? Especially for escaped slaves in the North. It's different because in the South, you know who's friend and who's foe from a mile away. You see somebody walking down the road. Are they black? Okay, they're cool. Are they white? Okay, they're a potential enemy. But hey, with a bounty on your head and the fugitive slave law enacted, and you basically hiding when you've changed your name, think about the incentive. For that, maybe a white guy, maybe a black guy, maybe a yellow guy or a red guy working next to you. The bounty on your head will feed his family for an entire year. That's a pretty, pretty powerful motivation to turn you in. So he loses this sense of community that he talks about, right? He's getting $1.50. Think about that, $1.50. So that's going to come to, let's call it on a typical work week, let's say you work 6 days a week, $9 a week, that's $450. The bounty on his head was $500. That's amazing, right? No wonder you can't trust people. No wonder you've lost your sense of community, right? Then chapter 11, he's going to talk about the Underground Railroad and the way this goes on, right? I was liable to be taken back. I was worried, right? I remained but a short time in this distressed situation, and then I moved on, right? He's got a couple little notes there about how he gets married, changes his name from Frederick Bailey to that Johnson, as he says. And then he reaches New Bedford. And for the first time in his life, he realizes all those things that those slave owners had told him and all those things that he had puzzled out for himself. Well, the North must be penurious. How can they even live if they don't have slaves? Because he knew no other economy besides an economy that was based on slavery. Now, however, he sees, oh, manufacturing does it. Oh, right. And we see him start to work for the Liberator. I think that's kind of where he leaves this whole thing off. Yes. At the end where he gets involved with William Garrison and starts to work on the Liberator, right? And then we get this odd little appendix thing, which is really interesting, right? He says, I'm writing this appendix because I'm thinking you might think that I'm an opponent of religion, right? So I want to take this away. I want to tell you that I mean this only about the slaveholding religion of this land with no possible reference to Christianity proper. For between the Christianity of this land and the Christianity of Christ, I recognize the widest possible difference. Okay, I'll buy that. So it looks like he's going to, a little caveat, a little tempering here, except, boy, this thing goes on, doesn't it? And what's this with the story here, right? Or this little false hymn and the parody, right? The little just God, and these are they who ministered at thine altar, God of right, right? The Christianity of America, he says, is a Christianity of whose votaries, it may be truly said, as if it were the ancient scribes and Pharisees, they bind heavy burdens and grievous to be borne and lay them on men's shoulders, but they themselves will not move them with one of their fingers. Well, I thought he was kind of tempering what he was saying about Christianity, but he's not, right? Could anything be more true of our churches, dark and terrible, he says. And then this parody of come saints and sinners, right, and sing of this heavenly union, this kind of hypocritical look at, right, or calling out the hypocrisy of religion there as it's practiced. It kind of leaves you with an odd taste in your mouth because it's so convoluted what he's trying to do there. I think really the big takeaway for me is what he leaves us with that very little paragraph at the end, right? I'm hoping this little book's going to do something toward throwing light on the American slave system, right? And faithfully relying upon the power of truth, love, and justice for success in my humble efforts. This last line. And solemnly pledging myself anew to the sacred cause, I subscribe myself, Frederick Douglass. Now, I name myself. Now, if you, on that second page of Douglass's stuff, with the pictures about his first wife and then his second wife and the scandal there, and if you looked up Assy Ottling, the woman with whom he carried on an open affair for almost 2 decades, I think, maybe longer than 2 decades, and then he turns around and marries this daughter of the American Revolution, one of the Boston Blue Bloods, this white woman, and he gets disowned by his family, and her family gets disowned by her. This self-subscription underneath it, right? That's from the first TV miniseries Roots, written by Alex Haley, and that notion of naming or subscribing yourself, right, is really, really important. Douglass talks about it and really kind of starts this idea that we walk throughout African-American literature for the next 200 years, right? Frederick Douglass gets to define himself. I subscribe myself. No master named me, I don't remember my name before a master named me, but I get to be an individual, right? Yes, I've moved from the representative of the community, just this nameless, faceless one of many slaves, to becoming an individual, but I'm also subscribing myself. He's self-empowering, self-actualizing, right? He says, on this day in Lynn, Massachusetts, I believe it is. Yeah, Lynn, Massachusetts, April 28th, 1845, right? I name myself Frederick Douglass. No master anymore, right? I finally get to be what everybody else, except their slave, takes for granted. I get to become the master of my own destiny. And this trope carries, as I said, throughout the next two centuries in African-American literature, right? And that's where Douglass kind of leaves us with that. Yeah, the Christianity stuff's a little puzzling, and yeah, the romantic kind of inversions of these three great narrative emboles, and that the kind of fake ignorance and the hiding and masking. Yeah, that's all interesting and unusual, but really kind of the lasting effect here is this idea of self-subscription and self-determination that he grabs for himself. Maybe he grabs it when he fights Covey. Maybe he grabs it when he escapes. Maybe he grabs it when he realizes that education is the way, but he grabs it nonetheless and carries it forward, you know, for generations after.